This is the fourth day of this October 2014 seven-day session. And we'll finish up now with the autobiography, or at least some highlights of the autobiography of Chinese Zen Master Han Shan of the 16th century. In 1589, I was 44 years old. In this year, I began reading the complete Tripitaka. The Tripitaka means the three baskets. That's the literal translation, the three baskets. And these three are the sutras, that is the purported words of the Buddha, the Vinaya, that is the monastic rules and regulations, and the shastras, which are all the thousands of commentaries on the Dharma, including philosophical and psychological commentaries on the Dharma. I began reading the complete Tripitaka. Also, I lectured on the Lotus Sutra and on the Awakening of Faith. Ever since I left Wutai Mountain, I had thought of visiting my parents, but I was afraid of being blinded by worldly attachments. For those of you who may not know, traditionally, to be a celibate monk meant to renounce, to cut ties with your parents and your family. Some have said it's because in China of the very strong system of filial piety that this was felt necessary to liberate or free the monks from the enormous responsibilities they might face in taking care of their parents in the parents' old age. So it became a standard thing. You were celibate, you cut ties with your parents, and you shaved your head. I was afraid of being blinded by worldly attachments. I then carefully examined myself to determine whether I would be able to visit my parents. And then during his meditation one evening, he had an experience where he spontaneously came up with some confirmation that it was time. At once I called my attendant and said to him, "Now I can return to my native land to see my parents." And then he continues. There was apparently in his home district, there was a temple called the Temple of Gratitude that had for some time been petitioning someone or other for the gift of a complete set of the Tripitaka. This set of the Tripitaka wouldn't be something just ordered from Amazon. It would be some magnificent hand engraved several thousand page collection. So Han Shan says, "I went to the capital to make an appeal on behalf of my countrymen, and the emperor granted the complete set of the Tripitaka as a gift. I escorted the sutras from the capital to his home district, arriving there in November." And then he describes how before he got there, this temple of gratitude was shining with a celestial light and all kinds of other things. I'm going to skip that. Meanwhile, my old mother had heard of my coming. She sent messengers to ask me when I would visit my home. In reply, I said that I had been sent by the court to escort the sutras, not to just go home, but that if my mother could see me in a pleasant manner without grief or sorrow or homicidal impulses, as if I had never left her, then I would stay for 2 nights. When my mother heard these words, she exclaimed, "This is an unexpected meeting, like finding someone of yours in another life from another lifetime." Overwhelmed with joy, how would I find time for sorrow? Oh, I shall be quite content to see him, if only for a little while. 2 nights at home is far more than I had expected. When I reached home, my mother was overjoyed. She showed no sign of grief whatsoever. In her, I saw only joy and good cheer. This surprised me very much. In the evening, the elders from among our relatives came in. One of them asked, "Did you come by boat or by land?" My mother immediately answered him, "What do you mean, did he come by boat or by land?" "What I really want to know," he said, "is from where did he come home?" My mother replied, "From the void he returns to us." I was surprised to hear her speak so. In my astonishment, I said, "No wonder this old woman could give me away to the monkhood." I then asked her, "Have you thought of me since I left home?" She said, "Of course, how could I not think of you?" I then asked her, "But how did you console yourself?" She replied, "At first, I did not know what to do. Then I was told that you were at the Wutai Mountain. I asked a monk where this was, and he told me it was just under the North Star. I then made obeisance to the North Star and recited the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin's name. After this, I felt much better and thought of you no more. Later, I just presumed that you were dead. For me, no more prostrations, no more thought of you. Now I see you as if in another incarnation." The next morning, I visited the graves of my ancestors to pay my respects. I also chose the site for the graves of my parents. At that time, my father was 80 years old. I joked with him, saying, "Today I bury you and so save you the trouble of returning to this earth again." Saying this, I struck the ground with a pickaxe. Immediately, my mother snatched it away from me and said, "Let this old woman do the grave digging herself. I don't need anyone else to bother for me." She then began digging up the ground in a vigorous way. I remained at home 3 days. When the time for departure came, my old mother was still in a very cheerful mood. Not until then did I become fully aware that I had a very unusual woman for a mother. Now, after hearing of all these bizarre, strange experiences that Hanshan recounted, at least up to the age of 44, that's all we have here in this autobiography of his that just ended. It always surprises me how straight down the middle of the road his Dharma discourse is. Just classic, orthodox Zen Buddhist teaching. He sounds quite normal in this discourse. And here are his words. I don't know when this was. I don't know how old he was. Concerning this great matter, the Tao, everyone has possessed it from the beginning. Everyone is it from the beginning. It's not oneself having the Tao. There is only this great Tao, this way. It is always with each of you. The difficulty is that from the very no beginning time, the wonderful illumination has been covered over by seeds of passion, streams of thought, the flow of conceptualization, and deeply rooted habitual thinking. This is a complete and very inclusive series of explication of what we're up against. The seeds of passion, streams of thought, the flow of conceptualization, and deeply rooted habitual thinking. We learn eventually that the discrete thoughts that flip through the mind all the time, that we have to refrain from getting involved in, this is not the real challenge. The real challenge is the layers of conceptualization that we don't know about, that we're not conscious of, and that we only discover by and by as time goes on, as we uncover more and more of these layers of the mind. And, of course, the deeply rooted habitual thinking. Some of this we're aware of, some of it we're not. It may take years before we realize that we're imposing this filter over our experience of the world. And what we're seeing, what we think of as life or the world, is just the filtered interpretation, the way we're interpreting things. It's like in the theater, they will sometimes use overhead lights that have colored filters, yellow, red, blue, that this plates that slide over the plain white lights that shine on the stage. And this is how, I guess, until full enlightenment, this is how we apprehend life and people and everything is in this refracted way that still think is the way things are, the way people are. These filters are our conditioning based on our upbringing, our socialization process, our parenting. All of these things are part of this filtering of reality and our perception of it. And not to mention, just now we know more and more genetic factors that cause us to see things through biases, subjective emotional consciousness. He continues, therefore, we have never been able to grasp the actual realization itself, but instead have wandered among the shadows of delusory thoughts about mind, body, and the world. This is why we have been ever roaming in samsara. Or in Hakuin's words, From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. Previously, the Buddhas and patriarchs who incarnated in this world, through the use of thousands of words and various methods, taught either the doctrine or Zen. Now, this is a way of dividing two schools of approach to Zen or to Buddhism. The footnote says, Chinese Zen Buddhists divide Buddhism into two distinct groups. One is designated as the principle, Tsung, and the other as the doctrine, Chiao. The former is the teaching of Zen, that's the principle, and the latter is the teaching of all other Buddhist schools, including all the sects of Hinayana and Mahayana Buddhism. Okay, so these, the Buddhas and patriarchs taught either the doctrine or Zen. All their teachings were nothing but instruments to crush the habitual clingings infecting human thought. There is no Dharma in the sense of something real or concrete in that which they have handed down to us. The so-called practice or work is merely a method for purifying the shadows of our habitual thinking and flowing thoughts. To concentrate all one's efforts to this end is called work. If suddenly the surging thoughts stop, one clearly sees that his self-mind is originally pure, genuine, vast, illuminating, perfect, and devoid of objects. This is called wu. Now here, this wu is not mu, apparently, but a different character. Because it says in parentheses, Japanese Satori. So let's use the word awakening. This is called awakening. There is nothing outside of the mind, nothing which can be worked upon, nothing to be enlightened. There's nothing outside of the mind, nothing which can be worked upon. Wait a minute. Didn't he just remind us, or point out, that we have these seeds of passion, streams of thought, the flow of conceptualization, and deeply rooted habitual thinking? Now he says, nothing that can be worked upon. Nothing to be enlightened. This is the point of view of our originally enlightened nature. That there's only this enlightened nature. We're into the inevitable contradictions here, because whenever we, to even approach ultimate truth, we have to get into contradictions, if we're using language, paradoxes. Nothing which can be worked upon. There's nothing there. The delusive passions, nothing there at all. Streams of thought, nothing. Conceptualization, ditto. Deeply rooted habitual thinking has no roots, has no substance to it. And then, for the kicker, however, the egotistic passions long accumulated and rooted within us are difficult to wipe out. So he presents things as they are. There's nothing there that is not even the thinnest membrane between us and our fully enlightened original nature, but because of these egotistic passions that have been so long accumulated and rooted within us, it's difficult to see our original nature. Fortunately, in this incarnation, through the help and instruction of teachers, the prajna seed within you has had an opportunity to grow. Sometimes we refer to this as the Buddha seed, as we do in the first of the three treasures. This is the seed that we all bear within us that can grow into Buddhahood, enlightenment. The prajna seed within you has had an opportunity to grow. Thus, your religious aspirations and your determination have been awakened. But you must realize that it is not easy to pull out all at once the roots of samsara, which have been deeply embedded within you from beginningless time. This task is not trivial. Only those of will and might, brave enough to shoulder such a burden and to press straight forward without the slightest hesitation or timidity, will be able to enter into it. An old proverb says, "This matter is like one man against 10,000 enemies." How true. Generally speaking, at this time, when the Dharma is in a state of degeneration, there are many who practice the Tao, but few of them can come to actual realization. Gropers and hard workers are many, but beneficiaries and finders of the path remain few. Why? This is because most practitioners do not know how to work, how to enter into the task at the very outset. What they do is to fill their minds with the words and ideas they have formed through thinking, or they measure things by means of the discriminating mind, or they suppress the stream of thought, or dazzle themselves with visionary bewilderments. Let's just mention one of these. They measure things by means of the discriminating mind. This is a real hindrance to so many people, in a way that they hardly even realize it. They're constantly measuring where they are in their practice, how much they've progressed or haven't progressed, and measuring their own ideas of their practice with their ideas of other people's practice, which of course can be all erroneous. This is such an impediment, this measuring mind. If only they would just cease and desist from this measuring. But that means first noticing it. You have to notice the many, many subtle, various ways that you're employing this measuring mind. That can take time to get onto it, to notice it, and to catch yourself at it, and then can swing the attention back to the practice, be done with this measuring, which causes us nothing but grief. Comparing one's ideas of one's practice with others. It's such a burden. Can you lay down that burden of measuring? Judging, evaluating. Some of them have stuffed themselves with the mysterious words of the old masters and treated these instructions or understandings as their own. That I don't see so much. I don't see people today in the West as stuffing themselves so much. Yeah, there must be a few, but mostly I think people don't do that, memorizing sayings, and certainly I don't see people treating these understandings as their own. They do not know that all these things are useless. This is what is meant by the saying, to acquire understanding at the hands of others is to close the gate of self-enlightenment. The first step you should take in Zen work is to forget about all understanding and knowledge and concentrate on one thing. Firmly believe that your self-mind is originally pure and clear without the slightest trace of any existence, bright, perfect, and ubiquitous throughout the entire universe. From the beginning, there was no body, mind, or world, nor any erroneous thoughts or infective passions. Right at this instant, the appearance of this one mind is in reality non-existent. All manifestations before my eyes are also delusions devoid of substance. They are merely shadows within the mind. Back to the essential. This is the core, the very marrow of the Dharma. It's from the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. Which is, of course, is impossible to grasp with our ordinary mind. What do you mean there's never been a thing? Well, what about this? What about this? Everything gives the appearance of substantiality. But we have the advantage now in the 21st century of the weight of evidence in physics, that everything that seems so solid is in fact just energy. There is no thingness to it, ultimately. It is energy congealed in certain patterns, some lasting longer than others. Smoke is a very insubstantial form. Iron is a very substantial form, but still energy. Vibrating and giving the appearance of solidity and some kind of substantial, ultimate solidity to it. These false appearances are because of the limited capacity of our senses. We have great range of hearing and seeing and so forth, but only in a range that is convenient for us in functioning in daily life. We can't see a millionth of the depth into the galaxies. We can't see a millionth of the subatomic particles. We don't need to just to function in our daily life. And so we haven't developed such capacity. We have instruments that can show us these things. And so we take beings and objects as having some kind of substantiality to them that they don't really have. All manifestations before my eyes are also delusions devoid of substance. They are merely shadows within the mind. And then he offers a practice here that I've never done and that there's no one I know of who has done, but I'll read it just to be true to his teaching. With this definite understanding, one should then search out the point where your thoughts arise and disappear. See where a thought arises and where it vanishes. And then he says, floating, delusory thoughts are rootless and unreal. Never treat the distracted thought as a concrete thing. When it arises, notice it right away, but never try to suppress it. Let it go and watch it as one watches a gourd floating on the surface of a stream. Never treat the distracted thought as a concrete thing. And yet, we tend to do this. People see these thoughts as something in themselves and aren't aware of how much they reify these things, make what is unreal real. Once heard a Zen scholar who spent many years training at Zen monasteries in Japan say that all of Zen comes down to not reifying concepts. Not imagining that ideas and thoughts and concepts have some reality to them. And then he says, when it arises, notice it. Okay, yeah, we're not pretending that these thoughts aren't flitting around in the mind. Notice them, but never try to suppress them. What you should do is to take up this awareness as if holding a sharp sword in your hand. This awareness. That's what it all comes down to, is awareness. All of meditation, you could say, you could reduce to the one word, awareness. I've heard that's one way to understand the word Buddha, is it means awareness. This is the delusion-cutting sword of Manjushri. No matter whether Buddha or devils come, just cut them off like a snarl of entangled silk threads. Use all your attention and strength patiently to push your mind to the very dead end of consciousness. Just push it on and on. The translator renders this as push it. This does not mean straining. That won't get you anywhere, except it'll get you to see the futility of straining. And that's not nothing. But it really means persist, persist. That's another key word that captures so much of this practice, is persistence. Persistence and awareness. Persistent awareness. He goes on. Those who determine to practice the Dharma should believe firmly the teaching of mind only. The Buddha said, all the three kingdoms are mind. All 10,000 dharmas are consciousness. Dharmas, when it's plural, it should be spelled with a small d, and it means things, phenomena. Everything is consciousness. And then Hanshan says, all Buddhism is nothing but an exposition of this sentence. Ignorance or enlightenment, virtue or evil, cause or effect are nothing but one's own mind. Not one iota of anything exists outside of mind. or we have these lines in the Affirming Faith and Mind, things are things because of mind. This mind is mind because of things. The Zen practitioner should completely cast aside his former knowledge and understandings. Boy, it would be great if we could so simply do that. But we don't, we're so embedded. This knowledge, former knowledge, understanding is so woven into us that we don't see it as something at all, much less something that we can discard. Completely cast aside our former knowledge and understanding. Here, scholarship or cleverness is useless. Rather, he should look on the whole world as hallucinatory. What he sees are mirages, mirror images like the moon reflected in the water. The sounds he hears are hymns of the wind blowing through the trees. He should see all manifestations as clouds floating in the sky, changing and unreal. Not only the outer world, but all habitual thoughts, passions, distractions, and desires within one's own mind are likewise insubstantial, non-concrete, rootless, and floating. Whenever any thought arises, you should try to find its source. Never let it go easily or be cheated by it. If you can practice like this, you will be doing some solid work. There are many koans which help you to work in the tumult of worldly activities, like the one, "Who is it who recites the name of Buddha?" I've never known anyone who worked on that koan from China, but we have others, and especially these breakthrough koans that are so fundamental. Although this koan is most helpful, you must realize that it is merely a stone for knocking open the door. When the door is open, the stone is thrown away. To work on the koan, you must have firmness, unshakable determination, and solid perseverance. You should not have the least hesitation or irresolution, nor should you practice one koan today and another one tomorrow. You should not entertain any doubts about attaining enlightenment, nor about the koan being too deep or mysterious, and so on. All such thoughts are hindrances. Here are more stubborn thoughts that we can be unaware of that get in the way. Thoughts about the koan being too deep or mysterious. Too deep or mysterious for whom? That's where the I inserts itself. All such thoughts are hindrances. I point them out to you now so that you will notice them later when they come up. Yeah, that's a big part of teaching, is just alerting the student so that she or he will notice these things that can so easily get past us. When your work is being done well, things in the outer world will not bother you very much. But the trouble is that mental disturbances will arise feverishly in your mind without any obvious reason. Here he talks about what may be considered makyo, side effects of strong sitting. Sometimes desires and lust well up. Sometimes an indescribable restlessness bursts forth. Numerous other hindrances will also appear. All these difficulties will tire you mentally and physically so that you will not know what to do. You must then realize that all these harassing experiences are produced by your meditation effort, which has stimulated into activity the seeds of habit deeply hidden in your store consciousness from the very no beginning time. Produced by your meditation effort, which has stimulated into activity the seeds of habit deeply hidden in the alaya vijnana, the store consciousness. So this is the territory we've venture into in doing a lot of sitting, as we do in Sesshin, is the activation, the stirring up of residual karma that normally just lies quietly on the bedrock of the mind. This is why it is so it's so difficult, meditation. It would be simple enough just to sit, just to make yourself more calm, but to do real serious zazen, as we do in Sesshin, means to stir things up, and then have to be able to ignore the stuff that gets stirred up, not get caught in it. There's nothing we need to do with this old conditioning. We just, if we notice it, fine, just let it go. Leave it alone. Never take them as real. Never subject yourself to their control and deceptions. What you should do is to refresh your mind. In this manner, exert your mind to the very, very end. After this stage, you will feel comfortable and infinitely light, filled with boundless joy. But this is just the beginning of knowing how to work. There is nothing wonderful about it. Never rejoice and wallow in this ravishing experience. If you do, the devil of joy will possess you. That's a saying that you encounter in Zen texts of all ages. The devil of joy or the demon of joy. And this means the kind of joy that will knock you off center and send you into raptures of digressions where you just forget about the practice. You're so ecstatic that you have no more use for the practice. It's a very formidable hindrance, because it's not recognized as a hindrance. It's recognized as the payoff of all this work. Hallelujah, now I understand it. But that too is a state of mind. And he says, those whose hindrances are too great, whose seeds of passion are too strong, and whose habitual thoughts are too inveterately rooted in their store consciousness, not knowing how to observe their minds or how to work on the koans, should practice prostrations before Buddha, recite sutras, and confess their wrongdoings. So, some people have found that this can be helpful, doing many prostrations in some mysterious way that no one can explain, that can dislodge certain obstacles in the mind. reciting sutras. That's chanting. That's what most Zen centers, when they refer to the chants, when we say we do, let's say, four chants in our chanting service, they would say they call those sutras. We do four sutras. So maybe it's either that he's referring to here, or memorizing sections of actual sutras and reciting them. And then confession, confessing wrongdoings, repenting. This we do from time to time here at the center. We always have. We're going to be doing it as a large group on Thanksgiving weekend in our ceremony of receiving the precepts. Repentance can have real power if you enter into it, like everything else, like chanting or the prostrations. If you enter into it with your whole being, really throw yourself into repentance, then it has the power to free you of guilt or shame. Okay, we haven't quite finished up this discourse of Hanshan, but our time is up, and we'll recite the four vows.